Amanda pointed out to me this week that this series we've been in has kind of gotten away from me just a little bit. We said this summer we were going to look at all the different Bible stories that we're accustomed to reading and look to see how they all form this cohesive whole, how they really tell one great story of God's salvation. And what she said, you know you're running out of summer, right? I said, yeah, I know that. She said, you haven't even gotten out of the Pentateuch yet. I said, yeah, I know that. So we're going to pick up the pace. What I'm going to try and do is, if you've not been with us this summer, or if you've missed a couple, I'm going to try and summarize what we've learned in about 30 seconds. God created the whole world. It was good, and we broke it because we didn't believe. First, we failed to believe, and then we entered into sin. And what we discover about sin is it's not just an action in your past. It's not a one-time mistake. No, it's a condition. It's like a disease, a virus, and you're a carrier of this condition. And it gets passed from generation to generation. And as humanity grew, the wickedness grew with it, until finally God has to cleanse his creation with a flood from all the wickedness of humanity, and he preserves Noah, the one righteous man, and his family on this boat we call the ark. The problem is he still has the disease. He gets off the boat and the problem still remains. The good news of the story of Noah is that God could have just destroyed his creation. He could have rejected it. He could have started over, but he doesn't do that. Instead, God chooses to embrace his creation. He takes that which is broken and he enters into relationship with it. That's what covenant means. And covenant, this relationship that God enters into, is the way in which he's going to save all that has been broken. Creation and humanity. So he covenants with the earth, he covenants with Noah, and then he covenants with Abraham. And this is special. It's through Abraham and his offspring that God is going to bring about salvation. It's through Abraham and his offspring that God is going to bless the whole world. Well, what's so special about Abraham? It's that when God speaks and when God promises that which seems impossible, Abraham believes. That's what's unique. He actually takes God at his word, the very thing Adam and Eve failed to do. And so God promises to bless Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And Jacob has 12 sons, and one of them is sold into slavery in Egypt. And Joseph undergoes incredible persecution and hardship and suffers serious injustice. And yet in the midst of all of that, God is still working out his plan of salvation in the world. Eventually, Joseph is able to save his whole family from starvation. And while they're in Egypt, they grow to be a mighty people, but they're enslaved. And so God enters in to save his people. He raises up Moses. He does this great act of salvation. We call it the Exodus. The high point of that is that God parts the Red Sea. The people walk through on dry ground. And when Pharaoh's army pursues them, he brings the sea down on them. And they're free. They're saved. But it doesn't end there. You see, God takes them and he takes them out to Sinai, to his holy mountain, and there he begins to give them the Torah, the law, the instruction. And these aren't just rules for rules' sake. It's not rules because God is some cruel tyrant who wants you to do what he says. No. Understand his saving purposes. God is trying to create a distinct community, an alternative community that embodies the blessing of God on earth. These are the people that the whole world can look to and see that when you live in relationship to God, when you live the way God tells you to live, it's really, really good. And then he takes them from Sinai and he brings them to the land of Canaan, to the promised land, the land that God promised all the way back at Abraham to give to his offspring. And that's where we're going to pick up this morning. This morning we're in the book of Numbers. Hopefully you had a chance to read Numbers 13 and 14. We'll kind of walk through that this morning. Numbers is kind of a strange name for a book, isn't it? I like the Hebrew name Bamidbar. It means in the wilderness. And that's really what Numbers tells us about. It's the story of the people of Israel while they were in the wilderness between Sinai and Canaan. And we come to chapter 13. Well, I should tell you this. Numbers is called Numbers because of the census. That's how the book begins. And a census at this time, it's not like in the United States. We count people all the time. We do regular census. They didn't do it like that back then. When you did a census, there was a purpose. It was an act of preparation. What you were really trying to do was measure your strength in numbers. They were counting the tribes and the clans and the families, but they were counting the young men and the warriors. Because God is about to bring them into the land that he's promised, but what they know is that it's already occupied. There's people there. So Israel's going to show up and say, hey, we're going to live here. And I don't think they anticipated everybody who lived there already just smiling, saying, okay, we'll leave. They're anticipating conflict. So they measure their strength. Chapter 13, they've come to the edge of the promised land, and God gives a very interesting command. He says, send 12 spies to spy out the land. One from each tribe. Send them in, have them look over the land. And as I read that this week, I thought it was a little strange. The text doesn't really tell us why. And I'm not sure I have a really good answer, because if you take God out of the equation, then it's just good tactics, right? I mean, if you're about to try and conquer land, occupy it, you really want to know what's out in front of you, but God has promised to do it. That's the promise all the way back in Exodus. God says, I'm going to give you the land. In fact, I'm going to drive out the inhabitants before you. Well, if God's going to do it, who cares about tactics? So why does God have them send the 12 spies? This is my educated guess. We'll call it an interpretation. I think it's a faith test. Because God has promised over and over and over again, I'm going to give you the land. I'm going to give you the land. I'm going to do it. Will you still believe when you know exactly what you're up against? I think it's a faith test. So they choose 12 spies. Moses sends them actually with more instructions than what God gives. He says, go into the land, size it up. Is it good land or bad? Is it good land or bad? Is it fruitful? We're not. And tell us about the people. Are they numerous or are they few? Are they strong or are they weak? What about the cities? Are they strong? Are they fortified? Do they have walls? What are we up against? And then he says something really interesting. He says, look for trees. Some translations say, look for wood. And I'm like, I like this Moses guy. Why? We want to know when we get there, are there going to be resources for us to build a new life for ourselves? So the spies go, and 40 days they go to the north, they come back, they survey the whole land, they come back with this report. They say, man, this land is really good land. I mean, it is really good and it's fruitful. It describes them bringing back a cluster of grapes. Not what we get at the grocery store, right? Like cluster of grapes. It describes them hanging a cluster of grapes over a pole they carry between two of them on their shoulders. That's a lot of grapes. That's a lot of grapes. It is really good land. But here's the catch. The people are both numerous and strong. The cities are large and fortified. And besides all that, we saw the descendants of Anak. It means people of the neck, tall people. I'll translate the Hebrew. There are giants in the land. The people are numerous and strong, giants in the land, and they all live in large, fortified cities. Now understand, at this point, they're only just reporting the facts. Then comes the recommendation based on the facts. Caleb gets up, and you can understand the crowd when they hear these things, that it sounds like the odds are stacked against them. There's this nervous murmuring that goes through the crowd, and Caleb gets up, he quiets them down, and says, listen, let's go. Let's do this. Let's go up immediately and take it. We are well able to overcome them. Let's go. And the other spies get up and say, whoa. We are not able to overcome them because they are stronger than we are. And then the other spies, they seem to begin to embellish the story just a little bit. They said, you don't understand, the land we went through is a land that devours its inhabitants. I'm like, wait, didn't you just say it was good land? No, it devours its inhabitants. I thought there were numerous inhabitants. It devours their inhabitants, and all the people of the land are tall and strong, and they're giants. We cannot do this. And then chapter 14 begins to spell out how the people of Israel respond to this news. It almost feels like mourning. It says they began to cry. They wept all night. And then by morning, they're back in their old habits. The ones we saw in Exodus. Every time they run into opposition, what do? They whine. They grumble. They murmur. The Hebrew has a sense of like verbal foot dragging. And then we get the content of that grumbling. It's an assessment of their situation. It would be better to have died in Egypt. Really? It would be better to die in this wilderness than to enter the promised land. How do you get there? How do you make that sort of assessment? Well, it becomes a little more clear based on the very next thing they say. It's really an assessment, or maybe more an accusation against God's character. Why did the Lord bring us to this land to be killed so that our wives and children can become plunder and slaves for the enemy? That's not what God said at all. But if you really believe that, then the course of action that follows makes perfect sense. Forget God. And forget God's leader, Moses. Let's get our own leader who's going to take us back to Egypt. I think there's a temptation here for us as readers of this text to kind of just sit back and shake our heads. Those silly Hebrews. Why wouldn't they just believe God? I mean, for all that they've seen, I mean, they watched God bring the Red Sea down on Pharaoh's army. Remember, the Egyptians are the dominant world power at this time. The dominant world, if God can destroy the army of the dominant world power in an instant, who cares about some tribal confederations, some little nations of people in the land of Canaan? What's the big deal? So the temptation is for us to sit back and just kind of shake our heads and say, those silly Hebrews, why didn't they just believe? If I was there, if I had seen what they had seen, I would believe. Would we really? If we're honest, don't we struggle with significant steps of faith in our own life too? Don't we? And so what I want us to consider this morning is that maybe there's a little more to this passage than what we've seen before. Maybe this passage really has something to say to us about how we follow God's leading when he calls us into something that feels risky, that calls for faith. Maybe this story tells us something about how humanity responds to the saving actions of God. And maybe that has a lot to say to our present situation today, in all the ways that God is calling you into this process of salvation. I've been going over in my head this week as I've reflected on the story. Why? Why would the Israelites be so resistant to a future that seems so much better than where they're at? What gets a person to that sort of place? I mean, they're in a better place than what they used to be. I mean, not 3 years ago, they were slaves in Egypt, and God has brought them out, and they're free. But remember, they're still living in the stinking desert. They're not planting crops. They're not doing much in the way of raising herds. They're just trying to keep their herds alive, and they really are just eating manna day in and day out and day in and day out. And you'd be sick of it too, just the same as they were just a couple chapters before this story. It's better than slavery, but it's not the promised land. So what gets a person to the place where they are very resistant to a better future option? And the best answer I can come up with is it's change. And there is something deeply seated in the human heart and in the human mind that is resistant to change. I mean, not all change. There's lots of changes we do like, right? The change of the seasons is nice. And maybe you don't like the change from fall to winter. That's true. Then you go to Arizona, and that's a change, and you like that. That's fine. We like to change our socks, right? Have you ever met somebody like so committed to a pair of socks, like, I'm going to wear these things till they're gone? Like, it's like a pathological resistance to change. Like, it'd be weird, right? We like our clothes to be fresh. We like to change what we eat for dinner every night, or supper, or whatever it is. I never know here. Third meal. We like that to be different because we like variety. But these are the sort of changes that they're incremental. They're manageable, and there's no risk involved with them, right? Change your socks, what risk is it? It's no risk. We become very change-averse when the change is seismic, when it's large, when it begins to disrupt our equilibrium, when this sustainable environment that we cultivate around ourselves gets taken out of balance. When the risk of moving forward is in fact greater, at least in our perception, than the risk of staying where we're at. Large change, seismic change. That's the sort of stuff we resist. I was reading an article from the Harvard Business Review about change management in the business environment, because if you didn't know this, for managers, for business owners, one of the hardest things about running a business is leading change, because people are so resistant to it. When you tell your employees you're going to start changing the way the company operates or anything significant, all sorts of bad things start to happen. Productivity tanks. People start taking more sick days. More people are likely to quit. You're more likely to see a strike in larger organizations. All sorts of bad things happen when you tell people things are going to change. We don't like it. And I get to the end of this article, and I can't remember if it was the author or if he's quoting somebody, but this was kind of the quote at the very end of the article. He said, people never resist change when they think it's obviously beneficial to them. People don't resist change that's obviously beneficial to them. And I thought about that quite a bit this week, and I thought, I don't think that's right. I think that's true in small incremental changes, right? So you imagine the scenario. You walk into your boss's office. He says, you know, man, you've been doing some really great work. Really proud of you. We want to give you a raise. Congratulations. Nobody will say to the boss, I don't think so. I've just had a lot going on in my life lately. There's just too much change, and I just can't really handle any more change. I'd rather you keep it. I just want to kind of maintain the status quo. Nobody says that. Why? Because it's a small incremental change. It's manageable. It's essentially risk-free. I mean, maybe it moves your equilibrium a little bit in the direction you'd like to go, but it does not disrupt the equilibrium. Well, let's imagine a different scenario. You walk into your boss's office. Boss says, you have been doing outstanding work. I mean, like really, really, really good work. And we'd like to offer you a promotion. So you've been a really faithful, productive worker in this organization for a long time. So what we want to do is move you up to management. And with this promotion, you're actually going to move to another city, and it's a really great city. It's the sort of city that has all the things that people who like cities want. It's a great city if you're into that sort of thing. And you're going to go to the city, and we're actually going to put you over the entire facility. So you're going to supervise, and you're going to lead this thing. And what we want you to do is help others create the sort of results that you've been creating. And we're going to pay your moving expenses, and with this promotion is going to come a sizable increase in pay. And by all the obvious metrics, right, that is a more optimal future for you. This is an incredible opportunity, and yet you would be amazed how many people would resist it. Why? I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why we resist change. The obvious one is the fear of the unknown. You know this city. You know this job, and you know your friends, and you know where you buy your groceries and where you're going to go home to. You know all of these things, but in that more optimal future, everything's in the unknown. You don't know where you're going to live, and you don't know where you're going to go to church, and you don't know which auto mechanic you can trust, and you don't know the best place to get the best deals on groceries, and there's a whole body of information that remains a mystery to you, and you don't know if you're going to have the same sort of friends as you had before. Maybe you had family here, but you don't have family there. It's not just fear of the unknown, but it's the fear of loss, right? That's the problem with risk. When you risk, when you gamble, you might lose. Because you've got a really good life right now. And maybe the future's better, but there's no guarantees. Maybe you move and it's a good job, but now you don't have any friends anymore. And so while you're making more money, you go home and you're lonely. And maybe it's hard to find a church where you were as connected as you were before. There's all sorts of things you could lose, even though you're getting a really nice pay raise. And then there's reasons even deeper than that. This is a reason that people resist, avoid, sometimes sabotage change that usually they won't name. The fear of inadequacy. Because you're really good at your job right now. People respect you. You know how to do it. You're comfortable in it. But managing is a different thing, isn't it? Very different. And what if you get there and you discover that there's a whole new set of skills you have to learn and new knowledge that you need to comprehend and digest and then use? And what if you find out that you don't have what it takes? There's this amazing stability in the now, in where your life is, and it's comfortable. What if you move into a future that's unknown and you discover that you yourself are inadequate? In the new reality, you just can't hack it. That sort of fear wells up from deep-seated insecurities. I think it tells us something else about our resistance to change. So often our conversations about change happen on that rational level, right? It's about reasons. It's about reason. So we talk about the advantages of changing, the disadvantages of changing, and that's usually where the conversation remains, but that's not really where the resistance is. Sometimes it is. Sometimes you just have really good rational reasons for thinking some given change in yourself or in an organization is a bad idea, but usually it's much deeper than that. It doesn't stay on the level of rationality. It's at the emotional level. Because all of us are deeply emotionally connected to our status quo and what is comfortable and what feels safe and what is familiar. Deep, deep emotional connections. One of the saddest things I ever learned as I was being trained for ministry came from a professor in our pastoral care and counseling class. He had had a clinical practice for a number of years, and he would tell war stories that were sad and tragic and true, unfortunately. And he was talking one day about addiction counseling and addiction recovery, and he said, what you'll begin to learn is how frequently as a person is trying to get sober, their sobriety is actually sabotaged by a family member. Scary thought, isn't it? He said, the scenario goes something like this. You've got a dad, he drinks way too much. He's complete drunk, comes home drunk, and when he's drunk, he's physically violent, verbally violent. He's just angry all the time. It's really a terrible home situation to be present to. And if you were to ask the family, you know, should dad get sober? Like unanimously, like, yeah, dad really needs to get sober. He obviously has a problem. So dad goes to get some help, right? Maybe he goes into a treatment program. He's He's getting some counseling. He's going to the 12-step meetings. And lo and behold, it starts to work, right? Dad gets sober, he gets clean, and he's doing a pretty good job, and he's got good support structures in place. But here's what you discover, is that when Dad's not constantly drinking, he's actually a very different person. He's not the same man we used to know. It's like this stranger is in our home, and he's fathering us now. And so now in the family, all the dynamics have changed. The relational dynamics have changed, how we relate to Dad, what we can say, what we can't say. See, at least when Dad was drunk, right, we knew the rules. We knew the boundaries. We had figured out how to survive, even in a terrible, awful situation. But now we don't know what to do anymore. And because the new reality is so uncomfortable, and because the unknown of what relationships will look like moving forward is so frightening, somebody will offer him a beer, spike a drink, and Dad falls off the wagon, and we go right back to where we used to be. And almost this sense of comfort comes to the family, because even though it's an awful, terrible situation, it's at least familiar. All right, why are we talking about this? Step back and see the big picture for just a moment. We're talking about God's act of salvation. How this whole story is a story about God saving the world, about taking a world that is broken and being ruined and destroyed by sin and putting it back the way it was supposed to be. Moving from here to here is a seismic, unimaginable change. It's a million seismic changes, taking all of humanity in the world from its brokenness to restoration. And this is true in us as well. Why? How does God save the individual? By entering into relationship with them. So at one point, you were alienated from God and wallowing in your sin. But after God comes into your life, there's forgiveness and there's salvation, and God comes to live in you. You go from alienation to habitation. That is a huge seismic shift in your life. That is a massive change. It's not just about God showing up. It's about what actually happens to you and in you. You used to be wallowing in brokenness and sin. What is salvation about? It's about God not just forgiving sin, but breaking the chains of sin, about changing and transforming the character. So before, you were alienated from God, wallowing in sin, and now you're called to be righteous and holy and sanctified. So that when you go out and live your life, when everybody looks at you, they don't just see you, but they see Christ in you. That your character's changed into His. That is an astronomical shift. Incredible change. And so what I want to caution us about this morning, what I think this story warns us about, is that there's something just programmed into us that might resist the way that God saves us. Because salvation always implies change. And heaven help us if we're resisting change and salvation. We're called to change. The way we usually see this fall apart, people know that the risk of staying in sin where they're at, once they've been convinced of the reality and the offer of God's salvation, the risk of staying where you're at is high, because you know what the consequences of sin are. And so we're willing to step out and accept Jesus' salvation. We pray the prayer, and we say the right words, and we do just enough to get convinced in our minds that we're going to go to heaven, which is what the goal is, right? So we're not worried about hell anymore, we're going to heaven. But once we get to that, we kind of put it into park. Why? Because change is uncomfortable. changing my equilibrium is uncomfortable. Going to God and saying, hey, what's wrong with me? And actually having him tell you, it's uncomfortable. It's not fun. But what Scripture's clear about is that we're never supposed to put it in park. That salvation is this ongoing process by which God purifies and cleanses and grows the human heart. Because on the spectrum of sinner, and I look just like Jesus, I don't think many of us are right here. We're all along the spectrum. The point is, we have to keep going. Jesus didn't say, come sit with me. He said, come follow me. Following in obedience always implies change. So the question for you then this morning is, what is that thing God is calling you to this morning? What's that change that needs to happen in your heart and in your life if you're going to continue to be a faithful follower? If you're going to continue to experience God's salvation working its way through you, what needs to change? And why have you been resisting it? I thought about that for myself this week. I thought about something else. It's not just true for us individually. It is. But it's also true for us collectively. Like as a church. One of the questions I have to ask as a pastor constantly is, God, where do you want to lead us? Because churches that put it in park die. It's just that simple. Take a church, put it in park. It might seem healthy for a while, but eventually it'll die. You can't get comfortable riding the successes God has given you in the past because God's always moving. God's always trying to encompass more territory for the kingdom. And we want to be the sort of church that's respondent to that, that's listening to that, that's seeking his will. So I'm always asking this question, God, what do you want your church to do? And as I thought about that this week, this is when I started arguing with God. Tuesday morning, I opened this passage up, and I'm reading through it, and right in the middle of reading it, I just got this overwhelming sense, and it's usually in my own spiritual life, it's not this clear. But just this overwhelming sense, God said, you're going to talk this week about what I put on your heart. I said, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. We went back and forth for a while. I said, God, I'm not ready to talk about it. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Why? Because I don't have all the answers. I thought, God, it's not good leadership to get up and start talking about things you've laid on my heart when I don't have answers to the questions I know people are going to ask me. I don't have them. I'm not ready to talk about it. I've not wrapped my mind around it yet. I've not even talked to the board about this, not extensively. I said, well, God, how about I take it to the board and we'll have a conversation about it there, God, and we'll pray about it for a while, and then we'll talk to the rest of it. God said, no, you're going to talk about it this week. I said, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. So this is me trying my best to be obedient. For some time now, God has laid on my heart that as our church, I really believe this, the next step is some sort of Spanish-speaking ministry. And I say that out loud, and that's scary. And I said, God, to get up there and say that, it feels like the Israelites looking into the promised land saying, God, there's giants in the land. I mean, not least of which, right? Does anybody in here speak fluent Spanish? Yeah, me neither. This would be a big problem, right, for a Spanish-speaking ministry. I mean, that's just the obvious one, right? Never done anything like that. Our church has never done anything like that, as far as I know. I mean, this is really uncharted territory. God, I'm not ready to talk about that yet because I don't have the answers to the questions people are going to ask me. And then Wednesday happened. We're just going to name it, right? If you don't know, there was a big raid on different businesses. Immigrant workers are being rounded up. It's kind of a big deal. You probably saw it in the news. I said, God, this is the wrong time to talk about this. He said, you're going to talk about it. I said, no, I'm not. He said, yes, you are. I said, no, I'm not. Why? Because the minute you say Spanish, it gets political so fast. So fast. And we live in a very polarized political environment. I said, God, this isn't the right time. He said, yes, it is. So there, I said it. And I believe it. I believe this is where God's leading us. I don't have the sort of answers I know a lot of you are going to want to have. So this is what I want us to do. In a couple moments, the ushers are going to pass these out. It's a list of questions that I really hope serve two purposes. One, I want them to be prayerful reflection. I really want this to be something that you ask yourself the question, you write an answer down, and then you take the answer to God to pray about it. It needs to be prayerful reflection. And then it needs to be a conversation starter. I think these are questions that aim at the sort of conversations we as a church are going to have. This is the first one. Will you commit to seek God's will for our church in prayer for the next 3 months? If you're wondering if I have an action plan, that's it. We're just going to start praying about it. And I hope you heard the language. I was very careful about this. I want you to seek God's will. I don't want you to commit to seek the pastor's will. I don't want you to commit to seek to follow the pastor's vision for this church. I want you to commit to seek God's will in prayer, in good faith, for 3 months, every day. And there's boxes there. Mark it yes or no. Maybe you can just be honest and say, no, I'm not ready to pray for that. Okay. Well, we don't do anything until we've prayed about it. Because what we need is God's leading. I'm not interested in a church that'll back my visions. I don't care about that. I'm interested in leading a church that's primary concern is to be in the center of God's will. Wherever that takes us, however scary that is, I want to be the sort of church that is absolutely committed without reservation to be in the middle of God's will. This is the fundamental question of belief. Do you believe that wherever God calls you to, it will be good and He'll provide? Do you believe it or not? If you believe it, then you'll be committed to following God's will, whatever He says that is. That's what I'm trying to commit myself to this morning. So will you pray for 3 months, yes or no? Second question. What are the giants of the land? What would scare you about starting a Spanish-speaking ministry in a church? You know what I wrote down? Leading into the unknown. And inadequacy. What if as a leader, I don't have what it takes to go there? I don't know anything about Spanish-speaking ministry. I don't really know anything significant about Hispanic culture. I feel totally unable to go there, which is why I don't want to talk about it. But if it's God's will, He'll do it. Third question. This might be the most important one. What do you fear to lose? What do you think we might lose if we make a transition and add some sort of Spanish-speaking ministry to our church? What might we lose? We just need to be honest about it and talk about it and give it to God and tell Him honestly how we feel about that. Fourth question. What would you be willing to sacrifice to stay in the center of God's will for our church? What would you be willing to give up? I wrote down two things. First is control. And actually, that was my answer to the last question. What do you fear to lose? Control. I like being in control. That's comfortable. I like the rhythms of leadership that I'm comfortable with, but this isn't that. But I'll give that up if God will lead. It's really easy for me to get up here and say this. It's harder to live, but I want to believe I will give whatever it takes to stay in the center of God's will for my life, for our church, whatever it takes. I'll do that. And then the last question. What do we stand to gain if we follow God's leading? What is the good fruit of the land? And I can imagine all sorts of things. Transformed lives for one. And not just people who would be touched by our ministry, talking about us too. When you step out in faith and follow God, your life is changed. When you follow in obedience, we'll be better because we follow God. Trusted Him to do the miraculous. Because we'd need that. Nobody speaks Spanish. We need a miracle. Or somebody, or I don't know. He's going to have to work. But here's the thing I've learned about the miraculous as I've been studying this. God does not traffic in the sort of miracles that don't require faith. He'll bring down the walls of Jericho, but first you have to cross the Jordan. He'll bring down the walls of Jericho, but you have to walk around the city. God will do the work, but you have to step out in obedience. Because He does not traffic in the sort of miracles that exclude faith. It's just not who He is. I can imagine the kingdom of God growing. I can imagine our church looking a little more what it would look like when we get to heaven. By the way, there's going to be a lot of people who speak Spanish in heaven, in case you didn't know that. Lots of them. And in fact, there's lots of them in our community. And as far as I know, there's really not a significant Spanish-speaking ministry. There's a little Spanish-speaking church in O'Neill. I'm not aware of any others. There might be, but I don't know. But a huge swath of the local population that needs connection to church. Good news of Jesus Christ. People to love and support them. I think that's where God's calling us. So in just a minute, the usher's going to hand these out. And, you know, you might want to come up after the service and say, Pastor, this is a great idea. Well, thank you for that, but I want you to pray about it for 3 months. Pray about it for 3 months. You might really want to come up after service and say, Pastor, this is the worst idea I've ever heard. That's fine. It wasn't my idea, by the way. You guys would know my ideas when you see them. If I got up here and said, we're going to start a woodworking ministry. We're going to build a little shop, and people are going to come in and build stuff. We're going to tell them about Jesus. You'd be like, all right, I think that might be. And trust me, I pitched that idea to God. He just said no. This wasn't my idea. I wouldn't come up with this. So even if you think it's a terrible, awful idea, will you pray about it for 3 months? Because it doesn't really matter what any of us think about the idea if it's God's will. That's the only question that really matters. If it's of God, it's going to happen. It's going to go. And if it's not, then don't worry about it. So will you pray? Worship team is going to come. And the ushers will hand these out. Take this home, pray over it, write some answers down, and in a couple weeks, what I want you to feel free to do, you don't have to put your name on it, but fold it up, toss it in the offering plate. I'd like to know what your concerns are, what your fears are. It's a conversation we as a church are going to have in the next 3 months. But the thing that concerns me most is we need a church that is committed to God's will, and seeking it in prayer. Amen?